Well, thank you, Mr. Henderson. Good afternoon to you all on a lovely day outside. We were a little concerned this morning when we had just a few raindrops at the house. I mean, no, not today. But we didn't know how we were going to fit 50 people inside the house, but it would have been a challenge. Let's see, we have two stories and the basement is mostly finished. So that's about 17 people per level. I guess we could have squeezed you in somewhere, but thankfully it doesn't look like we're going to have to do that. Well, it's good to see everyone here. We do have a few visitors. That's always nice to see. I hate to burst your bubble, Mr. Rushton, but I'm not sure that all the visitors came just because they heard you were speaking. But we do appreciate the excellent message, and it's certainly always well-timed to think about some of those things and issues of understanding God's Word more deeply. This past month, we've seen preparations for the Feast of Tabernacles kick into high gear. My wife's had some music teleconferences for the special music coordinators for the feast. That's fairly typical. She starts work quite a bit earlier in the year on that, much into the spring and then into the summer. It starts to get heated up. There are sometimes other sites, other church areas that do not have accompaniments for their special music. That's where we have taken our old keyboard now. It's in our home, and she does that and sends it out to other church areas if they don't have accompaniment or accompanist for their special music. So that's able to be done easily since it's on site now. We have a chance to get that taken care of. It's surprising what can be done these days with technology. All you have to do is she has to play it on the keyboard, slap in a USB, a thumb drive into the USB port, put it in her computer, and send it off. And the other area has the accompaniment they need. So it's certainly an opportunity. Two evenings ago, I and Zach Smith and nine others joined Mr. Steve McNeely as a member in East Texas, who with his dad, an elder in the church, operates an accounting firm. Mr. Steve McNeely coordinates the business office aspects of the feast and U.S. sites, so he was the one who hosted the teleconference. As the 11 of us with that responsibility reviewed and planned that aspect of the feast. I'll be looking after that in Orange Beach this year with the able assistance of our local treasurer and several other people as well. This coming Monday, Mr. Patchinger and I will have a teleconference in the evening with Mr. Phil Sandilands, who is the feast coordinator at the site we'll be attending, Orange Beach, Alabama, where we discuss our sermonettes and sermons for the upcoming feast in Orange Beach. I imagine Mr. Pavlik will have his site's speaking meeting soon, unless he has already had it. He's already had it. I'm getting a nod. So those things are all active and moving. On the local scene, we're looking forward to the Feast of Trumpets, just 23 days away. 3 weeks from Monday is the Feast of Trumpets. You realize that 6 years ago, when the dates of the days fell on the same days of the week, by the time we got to this Sabbath, September 7th, we'd already kept the Feast of Trumpets 6 years ago. It was very, very early that year, and trumpets came on Thursday, the 5th of September that year, and the feast was all over by the 26th of September. Everything was done. It was very early in that particular year. When you add in the Feast of Tabernacles to the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, and if you think about the opening night of the feast as almost like a separate day for us, I mean, God's day begins at sunset, which is why we have an opening service in the evening. But for most of our planning purposes, we think of it as a kind of a ninth day or the first day and with eight more to follow. There's a stretch in the fall that adds up to the most intense period of holy day and festival observance on the annual calendar. Or in a 22-day span, literally half the days are taken up one way or the other with God's festivals. Four annual holy days with a seven-day festival thrown in, only one day of which is an annual holy day, within a 22-day period of time, counting inclusively, from the 1st through the 22nd of the seventh month of the year on the sacred calendar, Tishri. Of course, in any 22-day period of time, you'll have either three or four weekly Sabbaths. If the first day is a Sabbath, then the 22nd and last day is also a Sabbath. added in. They may or may not overlap or overlay the annual holy days. Some years you have the Feast of Trumpets, the Feast of Tabernacles, Holy Day, and the Last Great Day all on a weekly Sabbath, as it will be next year in 2020. Now, what does that mean for you and for me personally? Well, many things, but I want us to look at it from a slightly different angle today. My wife and I were watching this week's edition of In Accord, which Mr. Henderson referenced in the announcements, and we caught the plug for the French Feast site as well. I thought that was cute, well done. I don't know the exact area, although my wife and I have been to the general area in southern France once or twice. It had a recorded segment from Mr. Arnold Hampton, the regional director for the Caribbean, dealing with Hurricane Dorian's impacts there. We were relieved to hear of the safety of two member families on Grand Bahama, which we had been told were, you know, sheltering in place, and we didn't know what had happened to them. We'd been concerned about them, and I'm sure all of you were too if you were aware of it. But I'm afraid there will be many others who lost their lives. There are still so many missing that it has to be that most of those people will not show up. They will simply be gone. They will be dead. Certainly, there will be property damage from the massive storm. You've probably all seen some of the pictures of just absolute devastation. We saw a video just watching this morning briefly. Somebody took a video from the second story of their home, and you could see the waves battering and bashing against the storm, the sliding storm door window on the second story. And you looked down the stairwell, and it was sloshing around down in the stairwell. And they were basically sheltering in their second story. Some people have retreated to their attics in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. It's now headed toward Massachusetts and then beyond that to Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, where it will still be at hurricane velocity. It's expected as a Category 1 storm. One comment by Mr. Meeker did make us smile, and again, Mr. Henderson already mentioned it. He spoke of the feast site in France this year, and he welcomed any who have yet to finalize plans. Now, if you haven't yet made your plans, I'm thinking it's not extremely likely that you'll say, oh, let's go to France this year. But you got to admire his optimism. And so that was a nice touch. He referred to the site as family friendly. And that got me thinking and connecting it to something that I already said, that this 22-day period of the year coming up is the most intense period of Holy Day festival observance on the calendar. Many years ago, what Mr. Meeker said about the site in France applied to all the places we kept the feast. My first feast was in the year 1961. As a boy of nine, we had been in the church for just over a year, attending for just over a year, but we had not been able to go our first year in the fall of 1960. We kept the Feast of Trumpets, and my parents kept the Day of Atonement. We were still brand new in the faith and didn't yet realize that an 8-year-old boy pleading to have his lunch was not really a valid excuse. But we were told by the pastor, since we had only been attending church for about 6 weeks, and that my dad had no knowledge, he was the one with the income, no knowledge of second tithe until 6 weeks before the feast. It's a little hard to save enough for the feast in 6 weeks. And so the pastor said, start now and begin preparing and planning for next year. So that's what we did. We attended in what we now call Big Sandy, Texas. One of Mr. Frank's recent letters made reference to the same thing. Back in 1961, no one had ever heard of Big Sandy until you got down there, and then it was a little white spot in the road without even a post office address. We all said we were going to Gladewater, Texas. That was the next town over that had big enough the population to have a post office, and we were going to Gladewater, Texas for the feast. Not that Gladewater was that huge a metropolis, but it did have a post office. And you know what? That first year, that feast site in Big Sandy was a family-friendly site too. Family-friendly in the sense that when the plumbing backed up in the communal bathhouse, there was a scratching at our tent door, somebody saying, hey, Walt, that was my dad, can you come help? The plumbing's backed up in the bathhouse. That was when I was glad to be 9 years old. So that was a family-friendly site. By that I mean that pretty much everybody either camped on site in Big Sandy, Gladewater, or stayed in little metal, non-air-conditioned sheds that were called booths. That was an upgrade in terminology. I think little metal, non-air-conditioned sheds would have been more accurate, and we stayed in one a couple of times. They were built on the church property. Later, they were air-conditioned and insulated and made tiny little dormitories for the students at Ambassador College, Big Sandy. We had communal bathhouses for restroom and shower facilities. Many of us ate at the dining hall, as it was called, or we called it the Redwood Building, because it had been, in past years, the tabernacle. When the feast site only housed up to 400, 500, 600 people, they would squeeze into this Redwood Building. But they outgrew it, and so we attended services in the new tabernacle, which was a giant metal, non-air-conditioned shed that could hold 8,000 people. No air conditioning in Texas in September and October. There was no air conditioning, but there were lots of really big, really noisy fans. And I don't mean the kind you find at football games. But it was the feast. It was special. Well, the sort of friendly, family-friendly part, well, let me ask you this. Do you remember car trips when you were small? If you had siblings, especially. Do you remember how fondly the family bonding happened in the back of the station wagon? Things like, that's my toy. That's my book. You're touching me. He's breathing my air. You know, things like that. Family-friendly trips. My point is that closer contact with family doesn't always lead to family harmony. So let's cycle backwards a little bit. Remember the part about 22 days in close contact with your spiritual family at this season of the year. Do you see where I'm headed? And no, I don't mean that we should all get in the same car to travel to the feast. But how will you and I treat our spiritual brothers and sisters in this season of God's festivals and holy days? We have 3 weeks to get ready for the beginning of the feast season. 3 weeks from Monday is the Feast of Trumpets. Will we treat them like family? And if so, just which way will that be? Because there's more than one way to do it. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5 and verse 13 from the Sermon on the Mount. I'm sure we all recognize it. It says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." It's familiar. Have you ever thought about those two examples a little bit further? You know, the salt of the earth thing and the light thing. We'll leave the salt thing for another message some other day, and I want to focus today on the light thing. Did you even notice, or have you thought about before, have you used some of those tools that Mr. Rushton was talking about in his sermonette and meditated on the fact that there are two aspects to being a light in these verses? Two different ways. Number one is the light of the world, verse 14. You are the light of the world. The example is given of a city that is set on a hill. When my wife and I have traveled to some of our Canadian area visits, especially in St. John's, Newfoundland, a place that the Chilliporas are very familiar with, having just relocated from Newfoundland to Ontario. We enjoy going up on Signal Hill. It's named that because it was the location where the first transatlantic wireless telegraph signal was received in December 1901 by Guglielmo Marconi on Telegraph Hill, Signal Hill, actually, Signal Hill in St. John's, Newfoundland. And from the top of the hill, as the sun sets, we've been up there to watch the Sabbath end, and as the sun sets, the city begins to just glow below you like a jewel in the dusk. It's a beautiful sight. And it makes us think just the opposite. We're on the hill, but the city's down below. But you can imagine it the other way around. We had the opportunity to spend 8 days plus in Israel back in June. That seems hard to believe. That's now 3 months in the past. But from just about anywhere around, Jerusalem is up. And so a city set on a hill very much applies to the city of Jerusalem. And when you see that, you see a collective light. Some of the astronauts have commented in the space shuttle or even in the earlier programs of Gemini, Apollo, even the Mercury program, where it was just one astronaut in the spacecraft, that from space they could see, they could make out the location of various cities as their spacecraft sped past. And sometimes cities would even specially wait until they knew in the early days, the capsule or the module was overhead, and then they would turn on the lights all at once to provide kind of a special effect for the astronauts up above who were watching. And so it's a collective example. If you had been in one of those space capsules or modules, do you think if just one person turned on a light, you could have seen it from space? I seriously doubt it. But as a collective group, it becomes visible. And so the example of the light of the world, a city set on a hill that Jesus gives, is a reference to a collective example. We are collectively the light of the world. God's Spirit should shine through all of us together to set an example. We've had that happen for years in the church. Individuals would say, you people are just about the nicest group of people we've ever had here for a conference or a convention. And that's a comment, and that's a commendation on the collective example of God's people. But that's only one example. Look at the next verse. Nor do they light a lamp, one lamp, and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. Now, how much does this one lamp cover in terms of space? How much visibility does it provide? Well, it says it gives light to all who are in the house. This isn't so much a collective example. This is an individual example. A city on a hill is a collective, for instance. One lamp, especially when you consider the kinds of lamps they had back 2,000 years ago, one lamp doesn't give off a whole lot of light, but it gives off enough to be seen by everyone else in the house, if it's in a one-room house, which was typical back then. That's what we need to think about today. Both aspects are described as the sort of example that we set, leading others. It says in verse 16, let your light so shine. It doesn't say whether it's your single light as a lamp or your light as a part of that city on a hill. Let your light so shine before men so that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, there's some interesting verses I want you to think about at this point. Keep those words in mind from Matthew 13 and go to Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10. And that's not the one I wanted. Okay. going to search, and I think I can probably find it. It would probably help if I were actually in Galatians, because it is Galatians 6 and verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, I have a visit to the optometrist scheduled this coming week, just so you know. Literally, I do. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. You notice that word household? The Greek word is oikios. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's O-I-K-E-O-I-S. It means those of one's own house, a relative, an adherent. Just think about that for a moment. As we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Remember what the words were in Matthew chapter 5? It gives light to all who are in the house. Turn to Ephesians chapter 2. And it really is Ephesians chapter 2. Verse 19. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints, members of the household of God. Same Greek word. Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord. Those are all constructions. Those are all edifices. They're buildings. They're houses. They're dwellings. In whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. and verse 14. These things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God. Slightly different word, same base. It's oikos, O-I-K-O-S. It means a dwelling. By implication, a family. More or less related, either literally or figuratively. A home, a temple. And Paul doesn't leave us guessing as to what he means. He says, how you should conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. One more reference to think about. Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews 3 and verse 4. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. But Christ as a son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. The word for house is also oikos, as it was in 1 Timothy 3. So here's my question. What kind of example will you and I be to our spiritual family during this year's fall festivals? I guess you could ask the question another way. Will you and I light our lamps in such a way that they give light to all who are in the house with us? We know that we're supposed to be a good example of God's way to those who are without, to the world, to those who don't yet understand God's plan. That fits more in the category of the light on the hill. But what about that other part in Matthew chapter 5? What about the part of a single, solitary, lonely lamp by itself that still is able to give enough light that people in the house are still able to see their path illuminated. That's what you and I need to think about. Those who are in the house for whom our lamp or our light is visible. What will it be? Will it be the squabbles of kids in close touch, literally, in a crowded car on a road trip? Or will it be the sort of caring, helping, example-setting light that we want it to be? You know, I don't remember my dad grumbling when the scratch came on the tent wall. At first, my brother and I, being 9 and 7, were very imaginative. We assumed there were bears in East Texas. But we were assured there were no bears. Scorpions, yes, but no bears. And so he went off to help with the bathhouse thing. We've been reading from several of Paul's recognized letters and one suspected one, the Hebrews. And we all know that this man, Paul, was the man that God used to write about half the books of the New Testament. So maybe he has an answer to our question now. He had a unique background. He was one of those self-righteous Pharisees at one point. So maybe he could relate to the kids in the car on the long road trip. And while the section of scripture that I'm about to go to isn't specifically directly about family, it's related, if you'll pardon the pun. In fact, Paul looked at one man this way. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy 1 verse 2, to Timothy, a true son in the faith. How did he feel about him? Verse 18, this charge I commit to you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies previously made concerning you. 2 Timothy 1 and verse 2, when he begins his second letter, to Timothy, a beloved son. So Paul definitely viewed him as family. I'm talking about what are called the pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Yes, they're written to two men who were pastors. Yes, they contain valuable information and instruction from a senior minister like Paul to be able to guide younger men like the two who received the letters, Timothy and Titus. But you know what? I'm finding it doesn't stop there. For one thing, Paul viewed Timothy as his son. That's family. We've seen that. And for another one, there's one key verse that we want to look at today that I want to build the rest of this sermon on, because it seems to encapsulate so much of what we, all of us, really need to think about right now as we near the fall festival season. The one verse is in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 12. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12. He says to Timothy, let no one despise your youth. Now, there was a time when many of us in the ministry, that was a factor. Many of us who've been around for years started very young in life in the ministry, in our 20s. It hasn't been a factor for a number of years. We can still be despised, but not because of our youth. But the advice that follows is good for any age. He says, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. So if we're going to look for some instruction on how to be a lamp, on how to be a light to our brothers and sisters who are in the house during this season of the year coming up when we're thrown in closer contact with them than any other comparable period of the year, I don't think we could do any better than to understand what Paul's talking about when he writes these words to Timothy. Now, it all comes with a context. If you go back to verse 6, if you instruct the brethren in these things, you'll be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished in the words of faith, of the good doctrine you've carefully followed. Reject profane and old wives' fables and exercise yourself toward godliness. For bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things, having promise of the life that now is and the life which is to come. That's a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance. To this end, we labor, we suffer reproach, because we trust in the living God, who is the Savior of all men, especially of those who believe. These things command and teach. And then we come to the famous verse 12 that we've already looked at. We've probably read it before, all of us. Maybe it applied in a different way decades ago. Maybe we can opt out of the let no one despise your youth part after a certain number of years have gone by, but we can't opt out of the instruction. Let me preface digging a little deeper here with a couple of other thoughts. These are the things we want to take with us as we go to the feast. Yes, it had a setting in its day. Yes, it was directed specifically to Timothy as a young pastor and a young minister. We see key components of how God's Spirit works in our lives in verses like verses 7 and 8. Verse 9 is interesting in light of Paul's choice of words, and let me explain that. In looking things up in a lexicon, I found that there are four phrases or word patterns that crop up in these three letters that are either emphasized strongly only in these letters, that they're rare or even non-existent in Paul's other letters. And two of them appear in these verses, two out of those four words. Godliness, verses 7 and 8, or godly, the word appears 8 times in 1 Timothy. It appears once in 2 Timothy and once in Titus. The word in the Greek is eusebia, E-U-S-E-B-E-I-A, eusebia. It never appears in any of the rest of Paul's writings, not that Greek word specifically. Obviously, he talks about being godly and having a godly approach in life, but that Greek word never appears. It means godliness or holiness, the qualities that God has that we're supposed to imitate, so that those qualities that are shown in our lives are directly connected to their source, which is God. Isn't that exactly what Jesus Christ said? He said, "Let your light so shine so that men see your light and glorify God." They're supposed to make a connection that somehow what we do and how we live is because of this, as they might think, crazy religion of ours. That there's a connection. The other word that appears, one of the four phrases, it says in verse, the faithful saying. We see that here in these verses. Verse 9, this is a faithful saying. Trustworthy in the New International Version. It's based on two Greek words, pistos, logos. And it appears 5 times in these three letters, the 2 to Timothy and the 1 to Titus. It doesn't appear anywhere else. I find it all fascinating and strongly believe it means we should sit up and take notice. So when we come to this powerful verse 12, let's take it as an instruction manual. How do I be an example to the believers? Not just an example of the believers, that's the light on the hill. But how can I be an example to the believers, the lamp that gives light to all in the house? Well, he gives 6 instructions, 6 ways in which we can be an example. The first one he gives is in word. You know, that's a pretty basic approach. Pretty basic approach. Even in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus basically said, "Let your yea be yea, let your yes be yes, let your no be no." You know, that's pretty straightforward. Say what you mean and mean what you say. It doesn't get much more basic or simple than that. Take a look at the letter of James, James chapter 3. James 3 and verse 2. James hits something that's hard for everybody. He says, "We all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word," so that's exactly what we're talking about, "he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body." If you never stick your foot in your mouth and mess up in something you say, consider yourself perfect. At least that's as close as you're going to get. But you know what? I don't know anybody who has never made a misstatement, who has never stuck the foot proverbially in the mouth. How do you do that? How do you avoid doing that? Have you ever had something just escape your lips and as soon as you said it, you say, "Oh, that is not what I wanted to assault my hearers with." But it's too late. You know the old saying about the bell once rung can't be unrung? You can apologize profusely, and sometimes we probably should. And if people are kind, they will say, "I forgive you." If they're not so kind, they'll say, "I'm thinking about it." But either way, don't you wish sometimes you had just never said it? He goes on, verse 5, he says, "Even the tongue is a little member and it boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body, sets on fire the course of nature. It is set on fire by hell or the grave." That's pretty challenging. "Every kind of beast and bird, reptile, creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and we curse men who were made in the similitude or the likeness of God. Out of the same mouth proceeds blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? No spring yields both salt and fresh water." How interesting that human beings are the exception. So that's the first way that Paul says to Timothy, here's how you should set an example. In Timothy's case, it was because he was a young man. In our case, it doesn't matter what our ages are. We're thinking about how can I set an example and be a light to those in the house during the fall feasts. We don't even have to go very far from that initial comment in 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy 6, Paul says these words. He mentions a couple of things of those who are... he says to many bondservants, as are under the yoke, count their own masters worthy of honor, verse 1, so that God's truth and his doctrine may not be blasphemed. Those who have believing masters, let them not despise them because they're brethren, but serve them because those who are benefited are believers and beloved. Teach and exhort these things. And then he says this, if anyone teaches otherwise and does not consent to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which accords with godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing. He is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions, useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds, destitute of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. From such, withdraw yourself. And then he adds these words, godliness with contentment is great gain. You know, some people see language and words as a vehicle for debate, for tension, and for difficulties with other people. I once talked with a man many years ago who was explaining some of the challenges he found in his life. We were talking, he was asking, how do I deal with this? And he said, let me share something with you. He said, when I was a kid, my dad's idea of good dinner conversation was to engage us in debate. He would throw out a subject or a topic, and whatever we said on it, he would play devil's advocate and take the other side. And dinner was a place for debating and tension. You know, if nothing else, I would suspect that poor man grew up with all kinds of digestive problems. Yeah, that's just sad. That's sad, but some people are like that. For them, they enjoy a good argument, they might say. But wouldn't we ask the question, what's good about it? What's good about it? So think about some of those things when Paul tells Timothy, Here's how you set an example for the believers. Here's how you can be a light to the believers. First of all, in word, in the things we say. There are so many proverbs we could turn to. That's a separate study. I'll let you go into that yourself. Separate study. You know, a soft answer turns away wrath. A word fitly spoken, like apples of gold and pictures or frames of silver. So many places we could go to. The next thing he talks about, he says, in conduct. You know, James, we've already talked about what he said about the tongue. Did James have any suggestions on how to deal with this problem with the tongue? Yes, he did. In the very next verse. In James 3 and verse 13, he said, "Who is wise and understanding among you?" It's almost as if it's still in the context of taming the tongue. "Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom." You could read further through verse 18, and it shows the contrast. To contrast with things like envy and self-seeking and boasting and lying, earthly wisdom contrasted to the wisdom that is from above. Verse 17, pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So in our conduct, are we peacemakers? Do we set an example of peacefulness? When people come into our presence, do they relax? Or do they tense up? It's one way to think about being a light to those who are in the house. So many other ways we could look. Jesus himself gave several in the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 7, he gives a very basic premise in verse 17. Every good tree bears good fruit. He said it as a premise in verse 16. You will know them by their fruits. Every good tree bears good fruit. A bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree can't bear bad fruit. Nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that doesn't bear good fruit is thrown down and cut down, thrown into the fire. By their fruits you shall know them. So when you evaluate something, look at what you're seeing. And if it's our own conduct, what kind of conduct is it? Is it good fruit? If we're constantly saying, "Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I wish I hadn't done that. I don't want to do that." We better analyze our lives and say, where's it coming from? What kind of tree do I want to be? The next step that Paul gave Timothy, he said, be an example in love. In love. These words were spoken by Paul to a younger minister. But do we have an example of how a minister is to show love to those he shepherds? Well, we sure do. Jesus' own words in John chapter 21. I'm not going to spend some time there, but remember the conversation? Peter had gone back fishing. They were all just kind of cut adrift. What do we do? The one who was the Messiah hasn't delivered us from the Romans. We've still got a problem with Roman rule. And then Jesus showed up, and they're on the shore. He was on the shore. They were fishing. And what was the conversation with Peter? Peter was going back to his regular occupation, fishing. Jesus said, "Peter, that's not what I called you to do. You're here to be a shepherd, and I want you to care for my sheep. Feed my sheep. Tend my lambs. Feed my sheep." That's how he's supposed to care for them. What about us, brother? All of us. Don't we all have a template we could follow? How long since you and I have gone over 1 Corinthians 13? And I'm sure you heard, as I did decades ago, I heard the pastor say, if you want to make this personal, put your name in 1 Corinthians 13. Every time it says love, or the old King James said charity, substitute your name. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and so on. Verse 4, put your name in there. You know, John Doe suffers long and is kind. John Doe doesn't envy. John Doe doesn't parade himself, isn't puffed up. That was good advice. You put your name in there and say, is this the way I am? Am I an example to the believers in love? How am I doing? Is there room for growth? Could I do better? Could I show God's approach and caring for others better than I do? I want to be an example to the believers, especially to focus on it during this intense season of Holy Day worship. The next step, he said, was be an example in spirit. In spirit. Well, I think we should all know where to turn for that one. But let's consider Jesus' words first. Matthew 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, which means you fool, shall be in danger of the council. Whoever says, you fool, the context seems to be, or the implication seems to be, that we so denigrate them that we think, why are you even alive and breathing? Whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, he said, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there. Before the altar, go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. He's talking about an approach to living. It's what we usually refer to as the spirit of the law. He explained it in other places in the same Sermon on the Mount. The spirit of the law. Remember, Paul's instructing Timothy in how to live, how to be an example to the believers. And this is part of it. Can you and I understand what God intends from his law? Is the sixth commandment only to prevent us from killing our fellow human beings? Is that all there is to it? Or does it go much, much deeper than that? Jesus explains it here. He says, you've heard it was said, you shall not murder. He says, let me tell you what it means when you expand it a little bit. Of course, don't murder. But he says, I'm saying that if you are angry with your brother with no cause, if you treat him as someone who is not even worthy to be alive, he says, you have broken the spirit of that commandment. And that's what he wants us to learn. So to be an example to the believers, we strive with God's help to live his laws and instructions, not just the minimum, but expand our obedience to God to what he obviously and clearly intends from his word. We could certainly go to Galatians 5 if we're talking about obeying God in spirit. It never hurts just to read the list again. Galatians 5, verse 22, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. How deeply grounded are you and I in those traits of God's character? How much do they define us? Do we habitually override the default drive of human nature to move to God's mind, his power, his way of thinking, his way of doing things? That's how to be an example to the believers in spirit. The next to the last one he gives, number 5, is in faith. He tells Timothy, be an example to the believers in faith. And again, we have an obvious place we could turn in Hebrews 11, but put that on hold for just a moment. Turn to Mark chapter 9. We might all say, there are times when I'm sure my faith is weak. And that's a fair comment. That's a fair comment. This is one of the most moving encounters that Jesus Christ had in his ministry for me. It's in Mark 9 and verse 14. When he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. And immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed and running to him, greeted him. And he asked the scribes, what are you discussing with them? And then one of the crowd answered and said, "Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. Wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they couldn't." So he answered him and said, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." And then they brought him to him, and when he saw him, when the young boy saw Jesus Christ, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. So he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything," look at these words, "have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." That never fails to move me. I believe. Help my unbelief. I know that you have all power. It's just hard for me to fully, unreservedly trust. Well, we need to go to God with that and say, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." We are all by ourselves, trusting in ourselves, of our own resources, weaker than we need to be in faith. We have to acknowledge where the strength comes from, and that isn't from us. And we go to God for the help. You read the rest of the account. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, "To a deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more." Then the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand, and he lifted him up, and he rose. And when he had come to the house, his disciples asked him privately, saying, "Why couldn't we cast it out?" Jesus had given them authority to do that on some of their travels. But in this one case, they couldn't do it. And they said, "Why couldn't we?" And he said to them, "This kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting." What is it, brethren, that we seek when we are praying to God and fasting? Aren't we seeking closeness to him? Aren't we seeking a wider avenue from him to us of the power of his spirit? Aren't we admitting that we have shortcomings and weaknesses and we need what only he can give? Sure we are. And that's exactly what Jesus told his disciples. They wanted to help, but they couldn't. It's a guide to where the strength of faith we need comes from, where the real source of the light has to be. If you and I are going to be a lamp to all who are in the house, there is a power source for the light. When you think about some of those things, then go to Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, and read it carefully, step by step. The last thing that Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:12 was in purity. Be an example to the believers, he said, in purity. A couple of thoughts. There are different words in Greek that are used in the New Testament for this one basic word. They generally have the same meaning, but they have slight variations. For example, in James 1:27, a verse we're familiar with, where it talks about pure religion and undefiled before the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, to keep oneself unspotted from the world. That's one word, pure. It's a different word than in 1 Timothy 4:12. One is katharos and the other is hagnia. But in 1 Timothy 4, the word that is used is hagnia. It has several closely related words used in other places. They may vary a little bit, but the root is the same. And the root word in Timothy means pure, chaste, modest, innocent, perfect. So it's not the pure kind that is pure without any, contaminants, so much as it is pure, chaste, modest, innocent, perfect. There are some other places where variations of hagneia are used, H-A-D-N-E-I-A. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 22, it says, "Do not lay hands on anyone hastily, nor share in other people's sins. Keep yourself pure." There's a warning there. You ever heard the concept about the company you keep? You are defined by the company you keep. Well, it's worth thinking about. A companion of fools is thought a fool. Ever heard that one? And my favorite related one that my grandmother used to love. Better to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. Pure. 1 Peter 1 verse 22 uses a variation of hagneia. 1 Peter 1:22 says, "Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart." The focus is on pure, modest, chaste, that sort of thing, innocent. Not so much that without contaminants we all have to battle those. 1 John 3 and verse 3 uses it, a similar variation. 1 John 3 and verse 3. After saying the first two verses, we often turn to what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know Him. Beloved, now we are children of God. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. And everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure. It's more a description of our character than a description of our chemical makeup, if I can put it that way. It's more a description of our character. We are to have the character of Jesus Christ. He is pure in the other sense too, with no contamination whatsoever. That's a goal. That's the goal of James 1:27. If you want pure religion, he says, then no contamination. Do good to others without expecting a favor in return. That's pure. But this kind is to imitate his character. And that's exactly what Paul was telling Timothy. If you want to be an example to the believers, you need to do this. Is that the pattern of our lives? Paul told Timothy it needed to be the pattern of his. And when you look at 1 Timothy and look at what Paul talked about in the verses that followed after he gave this advice, he expounds on it. Like a good dad, he went on and on even after his kid quit listening. You know how that works. But I don't think Timothy had quit listening. Verse 13, "Till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, and to doctrine." How about us? Do we immerse ourselves in God's Word? Do you smile when you pick up the book and open it? Do you want to know more? Are you reluctant sometimes to set it down knowing, well, I have to do other things. I have to go and do some other things today. How does it feel to read God's Word, to study it, to think about it? Are we people of the Word as opposed to people of the image? Because God's people have always had to be people of the book, people of the Word. How do you draw an image of eternity? How do you draw a picture of God? That we can pray to Him with the knowledge that He is our perfect Heavenly Father. Do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of the hands of the eldership. Some, like Timothy, were given the gift of ordination, but just about all of us here have been given the gift of baptism and God's Spirit through the laying on of hands afterward. Meditate on these things. Think about them. Timothy. Again, you heard about that in the sermonette today. Use the tools in the toolbox. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them. That's an interesting phrase. This is all part of how to not let someone despise your youth in Timothy's case. It's all part of being an example to the believers, of being a light to those in the house. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them so that your progress may be evident to all. Powerful stuff. Take heed to yourself and to the teaching or the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this you'll save yourself and those who hear you. Do you remember that I said there were patterns of speech that Paul only used in these three letters? 2 to Timothy, 1 to Titus. I gave you two of those patterns. One was UCB, a godliness or godly, and pistos logos, faithful sayings or trustworthy sayings. There are actually four. I'll give you one more. For homework, you can look up more scriptures. And for extra credit, you can research in a lexicon and come up with the last of the four phrases. Now that would get an A+, I guarantee you. Sound doctrine, hugiano in Greek, is one of the other phrases that Paul only uses in the pastoral epistles. It's used 8 times. 4 times it refers specifically to doctrine or teaching. Soundness, the definition says it is to be whole, to be safe and sound, to be uncorrupted. It's another unique word that Paul uses when he was teaching and mentoring younger men in the ministry. Brethren, we are students of God's Word. We are being taught and mentored by the head of this church, Jesus Christ, to assist him when he returns on the meaning of the Feast of Trumpets, 23 days away. That hugiano, sound doctrine and teaching, that's not bad to meditate on too, in being an example to all who are in the house. Is that where we are? Safe and sound, uncorrupted, whole. Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 4 verses 15 and 16, meditate on these things. Give yourself wholly to them, entirely to them. And that's what I'd like to leave you with today. The exhortation to think about these things, to think about being a light. We usually think about it in collective terms of being a light to the world, and perhaps as we have opportunity individually to be a light to people in the world, and that's fine. But remember, there's one other application Jesus himself gave in Matthew chapter 5. He talked about you light a lamp. You don't hide it under a basket. You put it on a lampstand so that it can give light to all who are in the house. Think about that. Our responsibility to be a light in 2 different directions. And think about it to those who are in the house with us as we enter God's great fall festival season.